Okay, welcome everyone to the second edition of Natural Dog Blog Radio. This is Neil Satin, and I'm the author of naturaldogblog.com. And this is a series of interviews that I'm going to be doing with dog training personalities out there in the world that you've probably heard about and maybe have questions for, but who seem like interesting people with interesting things to say. And today we have with us Lee Charles Kelly, whom many of you know as one of the other prominent natural dog training espousers out there in the world. There are still only a handful of us, but that is changing rapidly, partly because Lee has been quite visible both through being a prolific commenter out in the forums of the dog training universe, and on Amazon.com reviewing other books and videos. But primarily these days because he has become a featured blogger on the PsychologyToday.com website. And he's been stirring up controversy and telling people all about his philosophy of dog training, which is based heavily on natural dog training. So, Lee, it's great to have you with us here today.
Thanks.
And I just thought I'd give a quick introduction, though. You know, part of the purpose of having this interview is to get to know you. So we'll be, you know, asking you all sorts of probing questions over the course of the next hour. But I actually encountered Lee because way back when I had first heard about Kevin Behan, the creator of natural dog training, there was almost no information about him online. And as I was just telling Lee earlier, what the only information that I could find was what was information that had been written by Lee Kelly that was online in forums and random places throughout the web. And then his website at the time, which talked about a method of dog training that he had developed called the Kelly Method, which, as I understand it, was based pretty much on natural dog training, but we'll get to that in the interview. But anyway, so that's how I found out about him, and he is also best-selling mystery author. So we're going to talk about that more.
Let me just clear one thing up.
The
Kelly Method was a play on words of the Kohler Method. And it happened because a friend of mine, I didn't have any internet access for a long time. And this goes back to the late 90s, 1990s, 99, 2000, I think. And a friend of mine was on the internet, and she had offered me a screen name on her AOL account. So I said, okay, Lee Charles Kelly. Well, that was too many characters at the time. So we tried various other things, and they were all taken. And so finally I said, well, just call it Kelly Method. And so that became my AOL, or the Kelly Method. And that became my AOL screen name, piggybacking on her account. And then it sort of morphed into this identity, which is really, it's not really that different from natural dog training. It started as a play on words with the Kohler Method, if anyone understands what the Kohler Method is. And as for the novels, the main thing is that the main character is an ex-NYPD homicide detective who loves dogs, doesn't like people very much, doesn't like crime solving. So he takes early retirement, buys a kennel in Maine, and just wants to be a dog trainer, and then he falls in love with a medical examiner, and then all of the mysteries sort of follow suit from that. The interesting thing, though, is that I got the idea when I was driving around in Maine, because the stories take place in Maine, and I was camping with my dog, Freddy, in a little campground just north of Camden. And every day we would go driving around the countryside just getting lost, and we passed by this sign that said something or other kennels, boarding, dog food supplies, etc. So I went and I looked around, and I thought it would be great to live here and have this kennel. And then when I came back to New York, I told a friend of mine about it. She says, "Why don't you write about it?" I thought, that's the hook for the mystery novel I've been trying to think of to write. And the funny thing about that is that when Kevin was thinking of moving from Connecticut, he had actually looked at that kennel as one possible place for relocating before he finally settled in Vermont. So it all comes full circle in some sort of
funny.
Odd way. Yeah.
That very kennel he had looked at?
Yeah. I mean, when Kevin read my first book, he said, "Were you basing this this kennel on anything, any real place?" And I said, "Yeah, it's up near Camden." He says, "I looked at that place. I actually was thinking of buying it."
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. In fact, I think I may know where you're talking about. If it's more or less on Route 1 on the way up there.
No. It's not on Route 1. It's in the mountains. Sort of above Camden, if you can call them mountains, but they do in Maine, so I'll call them mountains.
I think they're called the Camden Hills, actually.
Are they?
When you're in Camden. But yeah. There's Mount McGuntacook is the main mountain there.
Right. Well, it's actually near the town of Hope, the little village of Hope.
Yep.
But it's not on one, it's on a gravel road.
Oh. Well, that would be a much different experience than being right on Route 1.
Yes.
Probably much closer.
I think I know the place you're talking about, and it's not that place at all.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Yes, I know.
So at the time, then, how experienced were you with wrapping your brain around and incorporating natural dog training into what you did with dogs? Because I'm assuming at that point you had a fair amount of dog training experience that you were incorporating into your novels.
Yeah, I wrote the first novel in 1997. I had come back from a trip to Camden, I think, was it 96? I don't know. But at any rate, and Kevin's book came out in 92, I believe, and I bought it like a month after it had come out. And initially, I thought he was nuts, and I kept wanting to throw the book at the TV or throw it out the window. But there were two things in it that I liked that kept me reading. And plus, I had actually come to the conclusion that nobody in the dog training world knew what they were talking about, that everybody was contradicting everybody else. And whenever I tried to go with one specific methodology, I would find that there were sometimes huge flaws in it, sometimes not so huge flaws. You know, I started out being inculcated into the dominance paradigm, and it had grown disaffected with it because I could see that it was having a negative effect on canine happiness. It really was, maybe it was me, the way I was doing it, but it was just making dogs miserable. I don't know how else to put it. And so then I decided, well, I'll just do the Kohler method and worked on that. And again, it's kind of mean. You know, I mean, I think I read somewhere that Kohler's philosophy about teaching a dog to heal is if the dog wants to have his head stay attached to his body, he'll heal. So, well, that's not nice, you know.
Put it mildly.
So then I read Don't Shoot the Dog by Karen Pryor. And says, this is it. You know, it's scientific. I remember in psychology class, I remember Pavlov's dogs and operant conditioning. This is the stuff. And it just fell flat. It just was, especially when I was asked to solve behavioral problems, And, well, let's do the desensitization. Well, you know, the dogs kept suffering. And I know a lot of people are going to argue with this because they're firmly entrenched in the behavioral science belief system. But to me, there were just major flaws in it. And interestingly enough, though, before I ever heard of clicker training, where you mark a behavior so that the dog knows that it's being told that it's on the right track or doing the right thing, which was invented by Keller Breland as a way of giving dogs signals at a distance when he was training hunting dogs. And so I had actually tried to come up with my own way of marking behavior at a distance before I'd ever even heard of Keller Breland and clicker training. Mine wasn't as what I invented wasn't as a good idea as using a clicker. I was using hand signals, but so I had been sort of immersed in that behavioral science view, and I read all of Skinner's, well, not all, but I read a lot of books by Skinner, and so I had a very good background and sort of basic understanding of the precepts, but they didn't work as well, you know. Mm. So so then when I found Kevin's book, I thought, well, this guy's nuts, you know. And because I think in the opening section of the book, he says, everything you know about dogs is wrong. Or everything we know about dogs is wrong, but everything we feel about our dogs is right. And that's a big stance to take. You know, everything we know about dogs is wrong. But it turns out he was right.
So you got his book, and it changed your entire approach.
Yeah, so what happened was I read it in one sitting, basically. And I thought, well, you know, I'm working with this dog that has leash aggression, very strong leash aggression. As soon as he would see another dog coming toward us, he went into attack mode. Lunging, snarling, just probably one of the scariest, worst cases of leash aggression you could possibly imagine. I think that there are cases that are worse in that the dog goes into a kind of an altered state. Mickey never went into an altered state. As soon as the dog disappeared, he was back to normal. But it was very scary and very powerful. And he was a lab pit bull mix. He was not neutered. And so I had been trying, you know, to desensitize him and distract him with treats and whatnot. And so I thought, well, let me try one of these techniques from Kevin's book. Now, I was lucky that Mickey was lucky, I should say, that he had a very strong temperament, because I did something out of context. I didn't build it up in Mickey. But anyway, I did an exercise from the book, and within half an hour of him being this crazy snarling maniac when he saw another dog coming toward us, as soon as he saw another dog appear in his line of sight, he would look up at me and trot next to me in a perfect heel, right past the dog.
Mm.
And I thought, well, wait a second. What is going on here? What have I just done? What have I just learned? And in fact, there's a little more to it, in that he was not just looking up at me, because I had a tennis ball in my hand. So all of the energy he was projecting, all of the aggression he was projecting onto the, you know, the offending dog coming toward him, was now projected onto the tennis ball in my hand and onto me as the, you know, the person holding the tennis ball. And so his attraction, which was a negative form of social attraction towards the dog coming toward us, was transferred back to me. And that's how he became and it wasn't docile. He wasn't docile. He wasn't scared. He was just like riveted on me instead of being riveted on the other dogs.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a transformative event, because if you can imagine the amount of energy that this dog had, that he was lunging and snarling and trying to kill the other dog. I don't know if he would have actually gone in to attack the other dog if he got close, but it certainly seemed like he would have. And to have all that energy, then all that wild primal energy projected onto me, but in such a safe way that if he tried to grab the ball from my hand, he was very careful with his teeth, would never touch my fingers. He would only touch the ball. And that was thrilling. It was quite possibly one of the most thrilling experiences of my life up to that point. You know, I never much liked roller coasters, so that was about it.
And the tennis ball factors in prominently in the in your books.
Yes.
So I can see why. I mean, that seem that it must have become quite the symbol for you of this radical shift that you had experienced.
Yeah, I mean that was the fulcrum point. That was what switched everything around for me. And then the next thing was that it was a dog I was working with, who a little Jack Russell Terrier. This was at the same time. In fact, it was like a couple days later that this woman that I had met in the park, and I had given her my card, and I don't remember if we met for coffee or I went over to her house or whatever, but she was in tears. You know, she had mascara running down her cheeks because the people at this dog training facility on Manhattan's Upper West Side told her that her dog was defective, that she should take it back to the breeder because he couldn't learn to lie down on command. Because at the time, they're now doing positive training at this place, but at the time they were doing all of the, you know, force-type training. So when you would grab him and push him into position, he would bite the trainers. And when you did it with the leash, stepping on the leash and forcing him down that way, he would just roll over on his back. So he was being both dominant and submissive, depending on how it was done. And so there was this you know, dichotomy, this sort of, I don't know what's the word I want, it's just, it didn't make sense. It was oxymoronic. It was, it made no sense. And so I said, well, you know, I just read this book, and I would like to try something from the book to see if, and within, you know, 20 minutes, of just playing fetch with him and then getting him to chase me around and using the tennis ball with my hands kind of making an arc towards the ground, I would get him to go down, not only go down, but he would go down while running and hug the ground, and then I would throw the ball and he would chase it. And in 20 minutes, this dog that, quote-unquote, couldn't be trained to lie down on command was doing it while running. So, you know, I became very popular with his owner. Because
dated kind for of, a number of years.
Huh?
I said dated for a number of years.
No,
it's interesting. I'm just kidding. But it's a great example of how a simple change in perspective, and when it comes down to it, it's not, I mean, it is radical, but it's not like, you know, someone has to learn a whole, they don't have to learn a whole new cosmology to just wrap their brain around some simple natural dog training concepts. But suddenly they can experience their dog's behavior in a completely new way.
Right.
And it gives you this totally new way of accessing your dog's behavior that, you know, for whatever reason, for some dogs, just the mainstream approaches don't work, and it's very common to have, as you know, dog owners who are completely worried about their dogs, or frustrated, or feeling like they're completely out of control, because once you've exhausted the common options, and they don't seem to work, or you or your dog's snapping at you,
right?
You know, then and, what do you do?
Then people are left with this dispiriting, awful feeling that they're stuck with this defective dog that they love dearly. You know, and what are they to do? And the problem isn't with the people; it's the problem is with the experts.
Right. You know? Right.
You know, the more you deal with experts, the further you get away from dogs. Unfortunately, you know, and even before, because you know, before I read Kevin's book, I had immersed myself in all kinds of studies, as I said, and yet I would see from my own observations. And from talking to people and saying, how is your dog, what's your behavior, you know, what have you done with training? I was always talking, you know, New York's a great place for this. You go to the park with a dog and suddenly you're talking to, you know, 50 people a week, or maybe not that many, but, you know, it's quite a few conversations that you have and quite a few observations you make about how people are interacting with their dogs. And what I saw was, in my own little, you know, limited data set, was that the people who had the best behaved dogs weren't taking them to classes, but they had tennis balls and frisbees with them.
Mm.
And that was the key ingredient. It was the people who didn't go to experts, but who naturally said, well, the only way that I can get my dog to relax around the house is to play frisbee with him or play fetch with him with a tennis ball. And they had, you know, they had come to this on their own, or else they had come from some background that gave them that knowledge. And it's so simple. I mean, it's so simple. Play is
now,
the most important aspect of the dog-human relationship.
Now, people who are regular readers of the Natural Dog Blog or your website or Kevin's site, they understand what we're talking about, but
right.
Do you want to just give your own kind of 2-minute quick synopsis of why it matters? Why would a people who bring a frisbee or a ball to play with their dog at the park, why would they have the best behaved dogs?
Well, dogs are related to wolves. You know, there's been a tendency in the past 5 or 6 years or so, with the advent of the Cesar Millan program, of a lot of people in the dog training community trying to totally denigrate or downplay or get rid of the idea that dogs are related to wolves. There's this whole thing of, you know, the DNA, the shared DNA between dogs and wolves is the same as between humans and chimps. Therefore, learning to train dogs by looking at wolves is the same thing as looking at chimps and saying, how do I raise my kids? Which, on the face of it, sounds reasonable, but except for the fact that, you know, dogs and wolves both walk on 4 paws. They, you know, one doesn't walk upright and the other does. Chimps haven't invented civilization or reading or libraries or, you know, art and culture. Certainly there are some similarities that we share with chimps and similarities we share with dogs in terms of the evolutionary precursors to human thought. You know, there's a whole sort of tiered system. So we share some of the same emotional aspects that we do with dogs and with chimps. But there's a huge gap between humans and chimps, and there's not such a huge gap between dogs and wolves. I mean, there is a gap. There's no question. But the point is that the wolf is a social predator, which is very unusual. The only other mammal that walks around on the earth that is a social predator is a human being. So that's something that we share with the wolf, and it's probably the most important aspect of how the wolf became the domesticated dog is because of this shared capacity to cooperate while hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, in terms of the evolution of dogs since they became domesticated, they initially, of course, the human or the proto-human or at whatever stage of evolution we were at was not in a position to spend time training the animals. I mean, Ray Coppinger and his wife wrote a book about the theory that the dogs became domesticated because they scavenged at human encampments, which may be true. But what evolved from that is putting the dog to work, to guard flocks, to herd sheep, to do all these tasks. And it wasn't until the last 200 years or so that dogs became widely brought into the homes as pets. I mean, there were aristocratic situations. You know, China had the Shih Tzu, which was, you know, just a house pet. And there were certainly European aristocratic people that had pet dogs. But I think that all changed in the 1800s, where the middle class started keeping pet dogs. And so that's a long period where dogs worked for a living, and what they did when they worked for a living was they used their prey drive in a socially cooperative context with their human masters, just the way wolves work in a socially cooperative context in order to hunt large prey. So in the modern world, we have agility, we have flyball, you know, and we have let's go to the park and play frisbee. And that all comes from the dog's urge to bite, which is the central, that's like the pivot point for how wolves became cooperative and how dogs became domesticated. The urge to bite in wolves had to be sublimated into cooperative social behaviors. Because you don't normally have predators living together because their predatory aggression is going to spill out onto other members of the group. So it's true that lions live in groups and they're predators, but a lion, if it had to, a lion could kill pretty much anything it wanted to without needing to work in a cooperative manner. Whereas a wolf, you know, doesn't have the same strength in its jaws, the strength in its muscles, or it doesn't have claws to bring down the animal. So they have to work together. So that sublimating the urge to bite, that's a hallmark of the formation of social groups in wolves, is also the hallmark of how the dogs became socially connected to humans, because the dogs that didn't successfully sublimate their urge to bite when they were scavenging around the human encampment didn't get to live long enough to pass on their genes to the next generation. And through the evolutionary history, that urge to bite became more and more sublimated into social behaviors. And because it gets sublimated, if it doesn't get some expression through playing tug, through playing fetch, then the dog's not going to be very happy.
So I'm glad you brought it back around to that. So essentially the people at the park with a tennis ball or a frisbee, even if they haven't learned how to direct that kind of activity into obedience or helping their dog overcome their attraction to squirrels or you know, cats or whatever it is, they still are, at some level, they're answering that dog's deepest needs.
Yeah, it's a primal thing. And, you know, it's interesting you say this because what I observed, and this wasn't true 100% of the time, but what I observed as a general factor was the people that played fetch had the best recall with the dogs. Whether they ever trained the dog to heal or lie down on command or stay or you know, do tricks was kind of irrelevant because the dog was always paying attention to them.
Mm.
Whereas the people who had been to the obedience classes, these dogs were, you know, not paying attention, and it was sometimes hard for them to get the dog to leave the park. Whereas these other dogs, you know, they were just like, okay, we'll go. They just do whatever the owner wanted them to do naturally. So that thing of playing with the dog is just so important and so key to what we do in natural dog training.
Now, it was probably, there was, I imagine, a certain amount of selection that was going on, meaning that there are still plenty of people who play with their dogs and who have aggressive dogs, and that's because they haven't, you know, maybe for whatever reason with their dog, there's something going on, and those people haven't learned how to apply the lessons of play to fixing the problems with their dog. So
yeah, I mean, I was speaking to a woman the other day who whose dog is scared of other dogs on the street. It's a little Havanese, lives on my block. And I said, do you play tug-of-war with her in the park? I mean, do you play tug-of-war? Oh, yes, we do it all the time. I said, but do you do it outdoors? Oh, yes, she loves to play with sticks. So in her saying she loves to play with sticks, I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, there's something in the way she's doing it that could be improved that might positively affect this dog's fear of other dogs. So you're right. I mean, there's that's the bedrock. Play is the bedrock. And then from there, that doesn't necessarily solve behavioral problems on its own. It goes a long way to doing that, but it doesn't necessarily hold true in all cases. Is that what you were asking about?
Well, yeah, it's what I was getting at, and also kind of like with the dog park, because, you know, frequently I'm sure you get these questions. I get them all the time. You know, my dog just doesn't like the dog park. You know, I don't get it. Is there something wrong? I see these dogs at the dog's park, and they all get along just great. And I have to tell those people, well, that's because the people who have dogs that don't get along well at the dog park, for the most part, stay home. And likewise, the people who have dogs that don't come back when they throw a ball for them, they don't take their dogs to the park to play fetch.
Right.
But, you know, what the overall theme being that what's useful about fetch is there's actually something in there that one can teach a person about how they're interacting with their dogs.
Right.
And, you know, the dog park is a completely different conversation, but as far as fetch goes, you know, there's just because your dog, I guess my only point was just because your dog can play fetch and might still have issues, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with your dog. It just means that you're actually further along the way to helping your dog because your dog already has that love of the game, and
right.
But within something like the game of fetch, there's something that one can teach any dog that particularly one that has problems, or if you're just wrestling with obedience, that where you can tap into that place in your dog that
right. Well, and a lot of people
that
will
same kind of. Go ahead.
A lot of people, when they hear this, they say, but my dog isn't interested in playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't, they say that, well, that's this, you know, like we were talking about how the experts didn't help all these other people. Now we're the experts, and there will be people who say, well, this philosophy, this branch of dog training doesn't work for me because my dog doesn't have prey drive, or my dog isn't interested in playing. Or my dog doesn't like to play. And so the hard thing in convincing those kinds of people is that, you know, dogs are born loving to play, knowing how to play, and it's because of some mistreatment or some misunderstandings that they lose not the ability, but they become nervous about it. They don't like to do it. Well, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Well, I love in those situations to say, well, you know, how much do you love to play? Because a surprising number of those people will confess that actually there isn't a lot of play in my life, or there isn't a lot of spontaneity, there isn't a lot of unbridled energy or joy. And so at that point, you really start to see the connection between an owner's emotional way of being in the world and their dog as a reflection of that.
Right. And one thing that that sometimes helps is if you just take the dog for a walk in the park every day, sometimes over a period of maybe a few weeks or a few months, something will start to change, both in you and the dog. You know, there was one of the people that writes at Psychology Today, and I'm sure he's right about this, says that walking through the park has more benefits than for depression than Zoloft or all these other drugs for depression. Just taking a half-hour walk through the park every day is actually more effective at treating depression than, you know, all the different named drugs you see on television constantly. And there was also a study done showing that kids with attention deficit disorder, if they go for a 20-minute walk in their neighborhood, their symptoms don't improve. If they stay in the house and play video games, their symptoms don't improve. But if they take a 20-minute walk in the park, their symptoms improve. So this brings us back to, you know, one of our natural dog training philosophy points, which is that dogs are our connection to nature. And the more disconnected we are from nature, the more disconnected we are from our true selves. And dogs can give that to us, but, you know, one of the, and this is tough living in the city, because I live very close to Central Park, but, so that's good. And there's a place, there's a kind of remote place in Central Park called the Ramble, which gets pretty close to being a natural setting, you know. You know, the further you get away from the, where the traffic is in the park. But at any rate, so dogs are our connection to nature, and so the more we can give them more of a natural life or contact with nature, the more well-adjusted they'll be and the more well-adjusted we'll be.
So that's interesting, and maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, because I imagine that there are a lot of people who are listening who live in an urban environment or a relatively urban environment. And so being right in the middle of New York City, what has that meant for you? Does it mean that it's always essential to find an open space like Central Park? Or, you know, how have you adapted what you've learned and the way that you train to being in an urban environment?
Well, you know, I have this couple, these clients with a Cocker Spaniel, and they live in the East Village, and their dog has some issues. And so I think we had our first, I know we had our first session at their apartment, and then I suggested that if they would come up to the park and we do a session there. And one of the things this dog does is, he goes after joggers or cyclists and whatnot. So we're in the park and there's people jogging, there's cyclists. And so I was saying, well, can we get him to play fetch or tug of war? Well, he won't play. So I said, well, let's just walk for a while. And it was fall, and so there were a lot of leaves. And we came to a spot where there were these, you know, this big spread of leaves, and he started sniffing around, and his tail started going, and the joggers were going past, and the cyclists were going past. And I said, I think maybe if we had a toy, do you have a toy in your knapsack? And they had a toy, so we got out the toy, teased him with it, and he started playing fetch and tug, and everything else disappeared, you know, as far as all the other people around, because, you know, nature took hold. So yeah, it is tough, you know. There are various parts in the city where it's hard to get to a natural setting. But I know of people who you know, pack their dog up in the car and drive to Prospect Park in Brooklyn, or drive across town to a dog run they like and take the dog there. But just like an outing once a week where you can get the dog that experience, and getting down on the dog's level, letting the dog jump on top of you inside the apartment, or playing a little tug, you know, on the street once in a while. These all can be helpful things. I don't know if I answered your question or not. I mean, changing the relationship so it's not about, you know, distracting the dog with treats or dominating the dog. It's about playing with the dog, changes the dog's relationship to you, but it also changes your own relationship to your unconscious desires and needs that are part of your genetic history. You know, I mean, one thing I ask people sometimes is, have you ever, you know, taken a walk through a pine forest, and how did that feel? You know, have you ever stood next to a waterfall, and how did that feel? These things stir feelings in us, you know, that are very primal and very peaceful, you know, and very necessary. This is why Teddy Roosevelt said we need national parks. You know, we need to preserve nature, and we need to do it in our lives as well.
Yeah, and it's getting people to that place with their dogs where they are more focused on an activity like play that elicits cooperation,
yeah,
that elicits emotional abandon, you know, or reverie, being in the moment, that sort of thing, which maybe sounds mystical to some people who are listening, but the gist is that that's what evokes your dog's most social, most well-behaved aspects, the most well-behaved aspects of their being is engaging in that sort of thing. And it's really fun for the human, usually.
Right. Well, two things. One, when I was a kid, I grew up in West Covina, California, which is like the sort of stereotypical Southern California bedroom community, suburban tract homes, etc. But at the time we lived there, and as I was growing up, it was expanding. It's probably expanded beyond belief by this point. So at the edges of the tracts, there were hills and scrub oak and all the things you have in the Southern California environment. And we would go out, you know, as kids, when I was in the Boy Scouts, I'd get together with some of my friends who lived in the periphery, and we would go out where we weren't supposed to go, and we would collect rocks, or we would, you know, look for snakes, and we would see kangaroo rats jumping around, and it was very interesting and exciting to us to be, you know, to take that step from the last tract house across the fence or across whatever we had to get to get lost in what was as close to nature as we, you know, and we would find toads and all kinds of living creatures.
You know, I think there's something really great in that, and this, I don't know why this just occurred to me now after so many years, but you reminded me about a very similar thing, because I grew up in a suburban neighborhood. We had some woods in our backyard, and I used to spend countless hours with my friends or alone in the woods. But now as an adult going back there, I see just how it wasn't even a woods. It was basically a stand of trees, or, you know, it was maybe a little bit more than a stand of trees, but it wasn't much.
Right.
And what just occurred to me was that for a dog is a lot like a kid. It doesn't take much. the adult mind says, oh, I need to expose my dog to nature. So, you know, I have to be in a, on a 60-acre farm in the hills of Vermont, you know. I mean, as great as that is.
We have to go to the beach every weekend.
Exactly. But for, in reality, for the dog, all they need is that stand of trees or something that really evokes their sense of play and wonderment, and they construct the rest. To them, a little embankment where they can smell the smells of nature, that puts them in the middle of a forest, even if they're not literally in the middle of a forest.
Yeah, I mean, when I worked at a pet store years ago when I was first studying dogs and whatnot, and there was this dog who had been sick and he'd been kept in the infirmary, and finally, he was well enough to go out, and I said, I'm gonna, you know, this poor dog, and it, the pet store was just was close to where I live now, actually. It was a block and a half from the park, so I took him to the park. It was autumn. He was scared. He was all the noises, the city, the people, the sidewalks. He didn't know what was going on. As soon as we got to the park, he just came alive. He was like, I'm free. I'm happy. I'm a dog. It was great. But here's the other part of it, which is that simply the act of paying attention to what the dog is doing while you're walking the dog down the street, and, you know, I need to write an article about, you know, leave your cell phone at home, leave your iPod at home when you walk your dog. Walk with your dog. Pay attention to what your dog is doing as if it's a group activity, and that's going to change the dynamic between you. The dog will be happier and better behaved. And this is something I found out years ago with my dog, Freddie, was that, you know, he was an intact male, and sometimes intact males get very fixated on the smell of urine of another dog. And, you know, what you want your dog to do is smell it, pee on it, and let's go. But he would just get stuck, and Dalmatians are like that anyway. They get stuck on this or that or the other. So what I found worked was, when he's really sniffing a smell and I want to get going, and my tendency is to pull on the collar, pull on the leash and say, let's go, and drag him away from the smell. What I found really worked was I would say to him, oh, is that a good smell? What are you smelling? Oh, is that a good smell? You're such a good sniffing dog. You're the best sniffing dog in the world. And then I would say, okay, and he would just walk away with me. Now, part of that is because I was transferring the emotion he was projecting onto the smell. I was helping him project it back onto me as the solution to his problem, which is, oh, here's something I can do with my emotions. Here's something I can do with my instincts, is just inhale the smell and get a, you know, it's like the first day of spring and you walk by a lilac bush. It's that sort of a thing. You want to stand there and sniff it for a few seconds. But by making that connection with the dog, by tuning into what the dog is feeling, it helps the dog tune into you, and then you become the substitute for that other stuff. I don't know if that makes sense, but...
I think that by doing...
So, you know, when you can't get to the park, when you can't get to the park, when you can't take the weekend off and go to the beach or whatever... You could at least do that, because this is, and the other thing of it is, if you're walking the dog down the street, the dog isn't thinking, oh, I'm not in nature. The dog is just thinking, well, what do I do with my instincts? What do I do with my feelings? And it's looking for things to smell. It's looking for people to say hello to. And if you're paying attention to how the dog is feeling, then you're creating a connection between you that happens on a very deep level, because really with... There's a big difference between, and I think this is probably borne out by neuroanatomy. The brains of dogs are smaller than the brains of wolves, and yet dogs are more intelligent in so many more ways, and more emotionally adaptable and socially adaptable and flexible. And that's because they don't need a big brain, because they're using they're using our brain as sort of a shared consciousness, you know. And I think with feral dogs, they don't have the same intelligence, because they don't have this constant interaction back and forth between their mind and the human mind. And so by paying attention to what the dog is doing, you're actually, even though you're on a city sidewalk, you're actually being connected to nature, because dogs are a natural being. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, it's good for the dog to be on grass or to be near trees, and it's good for the ADHD kids to go walking in the park, and it's good for everybody to go walking in the park, you know. But in your busy life, you don't necessarily have to have that, as long as you pay attention and establish some sort of directed focus on the dog and sort of tuning into what the dog is feeling in whatever way you can, because that will be beneficial to both you and the dog and to your relationship with the dog.
Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to say, go ahead.
Well, yeah, let me just say that I think a key concept here is that the disconnect isn't with your dog. The disconnect is with you.
Right.
So by being in touch with your dog and, you know, commenting like you did, like, oh, isn't that a good smell? Good boy, you're the best sniffer. You're actually bringing human mind and heart into alignment with the dog. And then that alignment makes it easy to take the next step, which is, you know, step away from the smell that they otherwise would have been fixated on and go on your way.
Right.
So sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Because the connection is the most important thing for the dog. In fact, that's why you're familiar with the whole technique of where I got my dog to stop scavenging by praising him. Well, the reason he was scavenging, because he was feeling a lack of connection, and seeing a chicken breast or a chicken bone or a pizza crust made him feel connected. And by praising him but not letting him get to the thing, the feeling of connection came through me. So that feeling of connection, it even, you know, sniffing for the other dog's smell, that's, oh, I'm connecting to this. Oh, I see another dog coming down the street, I'll connect to that dog. And so the dog is always looking for connections. And we're always looking for connections. This is why, I mean, I don't know if you see this, but walking around the city, I'm hearing people on their cell phones going, well, I'm at the corner of 49th now, where are you? Well, you know, 15 years ago, we if we saw someone doing that, we would have thought they were, you know, a lunatic, particularly if they, you know, had the thing in their ear and we couldn't see that they had a phone, you know. But so the thing is that by trying to establish all these connections through the internet and through the cell phones and whatnot, we're losing the connection with ourselves and we're losing the connection with our dogs. So, you know, leave the cell phone at home, leave the iPod at home, and commune with your dog, so to speak.
Yeah,
so anyway,
definitely.
The other thing I wanted to say about the West Covina thing, because you're right about the stand of trees, you know, it's not that big of a deal once you go back to it as an adult. But, you know, you wouldn't think that you would find wildlife in West Covina, California. And, of course, what wildlife there was minimal. I don't think we ever saw any coyotes, but there were raccoons. In fact, when I lived in Marble Hill, which is the northernmost neighborhood of Manhattan, there were raccoons walking around there at night. And now there are coyotes walking around Manhattan, you know. So anyway, that you can find that connection, and I think it's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Another, just for the listeners at home, one thing that you've mentioned a couple times casually, a word that you've let drop that I want to just highlight here, is the act of sniffing, which is an important indicator with a dog, as you know perfectly well, that they're in their body, that they're in like their most primal self with
right.
the potential to really tune in to you. So, and that's to be contrasted with a dog that's really fixated visually on things or with their ears pricked up.
Right.
That sense of smell is a great thing to be looking for when you're out with your dog as a signal that your dog's in their body and ready to engage with you on that level.
Right, right. Well, the story about the Cocker Spaniel who was somewhat stressed and was looking to chase and bite joggers and cyclists, and then once he started sniffing the leaves, then you could see the change in him, and you knew, and I knew that he was ready to play, perhaps. And
yeah, yeah, you can usually see that as a physical change too. You know, with the dog's body relaxing,
loosens up, and they become softer and more malleable in their temperament. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so why would you not use that moment of the dog's pleasure and being in its body, as you call it, of connecting to its wildest nature and say, I like you when you're like this?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because the dog will thank you for that little bit of pleasure it gets that you like him at that moment with his good behavior. It has wonderful changes.
As tacky as this may sound, I think that, you know, that's why I feel like I so often hear from people who are doing natural dog training, like, wow, I feel good. I feel so much closer to my dog. I feel closer to my kids, my family, you know, nature.
Yeah.
Because people are in that act of saying yes and embracing the experiences that they're having. And even if it's not the most desirable experience, you start by saying yes, and then you change. But you're always saying, you know, like in the sniffing the chicken bone on the sidewalk example, like, yes, you found that chicken bone. Awesome. That's the best chicken bone. Let's go, you know, let's get out of here. You develop that connection by saying yes. And so many people learn to say no. You know, it's probably
right.
From their parents and the just that imprinting that happens when you're young and it's nothing, you know, through no fault of your parents. They're afraid for your safety or whatever, so they discourage you from doing things. But
right. Well,
that's something that you need to overcome, you know, as you grow older, I think.
Yeah, you know, and there's this dachshund I'm working with now who kind of has, I think he really did have what they call reactive attachment disorder, which is where adopted kids haven't had the proper nurturing and they try to kill their adopted parents. You know, there's some really amazing stories. This was in the news with this kid from Russia that got sent back to Russia. But these terrible stories of kids who booby trap the house, want to burn down the house. You know, that, I mean, that's a side issue from dogs. But what this dog had was a similar thing where he had been traumatized. He hadn't been neglected. He'd been traumatized, apparently, as a puppy. And then they tried to adopt him out 3 or 4 times. And then the fourth person that adopted him, he was biting his owners. You know, he would be a Jekyll and Hyde. Sometimes he was perfect, and sometimes he would go into a sort of altered state. He would get a glazed look on his eyes you know, just walking him in the park the other day, he started smelling the grass and rolling over on his back, and he's become so much sweeter. And a lot less hide moments, and they're even easily controllable now. But partly because, we're doing the pushing exercise with him, and we're doing these other things. But we're saying yes to his sniffing, and we're saying yes to his exulting in the grass, and he feels much more relaxed now and happier, and he's a, you know. He's a really good dog now.
Mm.
So,
have you had people contact you after having read your mystery novels for whom those alone have really transformed their experience
with
their dog?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There was, when my first novel came out, there was this woman who had a poodle miniature poodle named Charlie, and she'd been told that he had classic alpha tendencies, and he was biting her, and she had been given this list of things not to do with the dog or things to do with the dog to, you know, to maintain her alpha status. And she'd been living with this for 4 years, and there's a scene in the novel where the first novel where Jack is talking to this deputy about his dog Emma, who's a lab who's been trained by a Nazi dog trainer who actually was based on the that kennel you were talking about on Route 1. So Jack's retraining her by just running around in the snow, falling down, letting her jump on top of him and running away, and then throwing the ball, and then slowly introducing the commands that had scared her before because she'd been punished into submission during her training, and so that she became like this different dog. Now, that's fictional. That's partly based on fact. It's actually based on that Jack Russell Terrier I mentioned who, you know, flunked out of training school in Manhattan. But this woman with the poodle read that, and when she was first reading the book, she was thinking, this guy's crazy. You know, I know that this is wrong. He's saying that there's no alpha. He's saying there's no dominance. That's wrong. Well, I like the book. I'll just keep reading. So after reading that scene, was the last scene I think she read before going to bed, she decided to try it, and luckily there was snow in the yard. And she had two poodles, actually, Sarge and Charlie, and Charlie was fine, but, I mean, Sarge was fine, but Charlie was this dog with classic alpha tendencies. And what she said was that after playing like a nut and worried that the neighbors would think she was crazy, A, she had a good time, and B, for the first time since she adopted him, Charlie, sorry, I'm getting choked up about this, but for the first time since she adopted him, Charlie made eye contact with her. You know, I mean, that's 4 years of isolation and unhappiness and
it's profound. And how awesome that, you know, that's just, it shows you the transformative power of literature, you know.
Well, I don't know if it's literature, but you know, they're clever stories in a way. But yeah, I mean, that made anything else that came out of that or didn't come out of that novel irrelevant in a sense, because there's Charlie.
Well, it's worth mentioning at this point that your books and the concepts behind them have been optioned by, is it Warner Brothers?
Yes.
And they're working on a TV pilot right now?
Yeah, they...
What about that?
The executive vice president programming in charge of basic cable, the arm, the branch of Warner Brothers that does that sort of thing, I guess read one of my novels and sent me an email immediately afterward and said, can we turn this into a TV series? And yeah, that's in the works right now. So we'll see what happens. They, you know, they have some different ideas, but hopefully they'll keep the dog training angle.
Yeah, hopefully they will.
Well, no, I mean they're going to keep the dog training angle, but I mean hopefully they won't. They'll understand the natural dog training philosophy when it comes to the series.
Right.
But either way,
right.
It's going to either you know either way it's going to be I think it's going to be interesting. And it's going to hopefully be a good thing.
That's awesome. Awesome. Well, Lee, it's been really awesome talking to you. And I just want to remind everyone that Lee's website, he has many websites, but...
I have one website. I have one website, and I have a blog, and I have a ning.com discussion site, and I have a little blog on psychologytoday.com. But, yeah, the www.leecharleskelly.com is the main website.
Right, and it's Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, just so all of you out there know.
It doesn't actually matter.
Oh, it doesn't?
No, if you Google it, they'll redirect you to the E-Y.
Well, yeah, just use the Google, people.
Yeah.
And I have to also just, you know, one last question for you, and this is maybe slightly off topic, slightly not, but I mean, you're obviously a very diverse guy. You're working with dogs, you're writing books, you play music and write music. So I'm wondering, just at a general level, how do you balance it? What's your strategy for keeping your life balanced with all your interests and things that you're pursuing?
I don't have a strategy. I can't think. I'm trying to think if I have a strategy. No, I just, I don't know. I'm constantly thinking about stuff. And if I'm not thinking about a topic for a blog article, I'm thinking about a song lyric, or it's more about, I think it's more about OCD than anything else. No, but you know, and so sometimes I get too much in my head, and being with the dogs grounds me. You know, I have a dog staying with me this weekend, a Welsh Springer named Caleb, took him to the park this morning and played fetch with him. And, that was very cool to just walk to the park and do that. And, I don't know how to answer that question. It's just, I turn my attention to various places, see what, sort of culminates from that.
And I think that's a good point, that interacting with your dog or a dog is a great way to keep yourself centered if you do it in the manner that we're talking about, which is
right.
Being focused on your interaction with your dog.
Some of the things we were talking about in those terms about the no and what we learned from our parents goes to this theme that I've started elaborating on recently of the Freudian dynamic really explains the dog-human relationship far better than the Conrad Lorenzian dominant and submissive thing. Conrad Lorenz was a ethologist from Nazi Germany that gave us the idea that dogs and wolves engage in dominant and submissive behaviors with one another, and the whole pack leader mentality came out of that whole mythology goes directly back to Conrad Lorenz and Nazi Germany, and it also the Freudian and people are scratching their heads now or turning off the thing, the Freudian dynamic is much more accurate than the Pavlovian or the Skinnerian idea of classical conditioning or operant conditioning. In fact, the idea of positive reinforcement is simply a clinical outgrowth of Freud's pleasure principle, the idea that animals tend to seek out pleasurable experiences and tend to avoid painful experiences. That comes straight from Freud, and Skinner just expanded on it in a very clinical laboratory kind of a way. But the main dynamic, which is that Freud said that the mind is an energy system, and that the older parts of the mind, the older parts of the brain, the, you know, evolutionarily speaking, the precursors to higher intellectual functions of the human brain, all these things, the emotions and the drives and the urges and impulses, are, in Freud's view, the id, and that the ego, the ego's job is to pick which one of those, or which, if any of those impulses are acted on in terms of how it fits into society and how it fits into real life. And so the ego is always putting a lid on the emotions. And we're always putting a lid on our dogs. You know, when they're puppies, we're trying to stop them. No, don't do that. Don't chew that. And so this whole dynamic develops where the unadulterated, uninhibited id is in control, is being controlled by the owner. And once we learn to interact with our dogs playfully, we get back to that childhood state when we weren't being pressured or you know, had the lid put on our impulses by our parents. Now, obviously, that has to happen. There's no getting around it. You have to, there has to be some governing mechanism that says, you can do this, but you can't do that. You know, that's true. But what happens with dogs is when you accidentally repress something that needs to be expressed, that energy has to come out some way, and that's where you get neurotic behavior. And so understanding that dynamic of how repression creates neurotic behavior later on, I think is much better at helping us solve behavioral problems in dogs than saying, well, let's desensitize the dog because that's what the behavioral science has to do. We don't want to desensitize the dog. We want to say, oh, I see. You're doing this because when you were a puppy, you were punished for mouthing your owners. Well, let's give you something that gives you that pleasure, but that is safe. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I've written several articles on this, so, and when I've talked to people about it, they seemed intrigued, but I can't tell how many people are, you know, saying, well, he's totally nuts or not.
One thing that I think is interesting, and I didn't realize this until relatively recently, is that Freud is actually part of a lineage that includes Mesmer and... you know, this idea that there's a substance, and, you know, we've been calling it emotional energy a lot in our conversations, but
right.
But there's a substance that actually is transmitted by humans to other humans, and, you know, when we talk about it with our dogs, we're including dogs in the equation as well. But, you know, I never realized that, you know, because... You tend to think of Freud and psychoanalysis as being this really like cerebral, heady thing, but in fact, it all comes out of this idea that there's this emotional energy that is transmitted and needs to be expressed and needs an outlet and flows like electricity.
Right, right. And well, Freud was very much influenced by Darwin, and he was also very much influenced by the research that was coming out about. Electricity, magnetism, you know, Faraday and whatnot. And in fact, the conservation of energy is a key element of his philosophy that the brain engages in economy. He talks about economy a lot, and what he means is how the energy is used or not used. And just so people don't think I'm totally crazy, I once had a client. They called me up and they said their dog was obsessively licking doorknobs. And I thought, well, this is interesting. How does this happen? So I knew that licking can often be a way of sublimating the urge to bite. So the urge to bite is repressed, so it has to come out some way. So sometimes dogs will lick obsessively. You see this with a lot of pit bulls are very much like this, because a lot of people are afraid that the pit bull is going to grow up to be a problem because of their reputation. So they really repress any oral impulses that the pit bull has as a puppy. And as a result, what do you get? You get a dog who's jumping up on everybody and licking them to death because that energy didn't come out naturally the way it should have during puppyhood. So anyway, I go over to the client's house, and as soon as I come in, this dog, a little Wheaton Terrier, not very big, starts jumping up and licking the doorknob of the front door. And she just jumps up and down, lick, 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 lick. And she does it for 20 minutes. So it occurs to me that maybe the dog had been punished for mouthing or nipping when she was a puppy. And I asked the question. They said, sure enough. And that's when it clicked for me that this was a Freudian perfect case of a transference where the drive to connect to the environment through one's teeth became repressed. And so instead of connecting to the owners in a nice, gentle way of mouthing their hands or playfully by nipping their pajama bottoms when they're getting ready for work in the morning, you know, whatever puppies normally do and what other people normally do, that had been severely repressed, but the energy was still there, and that was coming out and was transferred from the owners onto the doorknob, because the doorknob was the place where the owners left her alone every day, and then it was the place where they came back, and they were using their hands. And they had repressed the dog's oral impulses by grabbing her snout with their hand and hitting her under the chin with their other hand and saying, no, bad bite, or whatever they said. And so to me, it seems very clear that this was a neurotic behavior that could be explained very clearly along neo-Freudian lines.
I'll be curious. I haven't had a chance to do much reading, but my hunch has been that there's actually probably a lot of really useful information in Wilhelm Reich's writings that would have a lot of bearing on this conversation.
Well, yeah. Wilhelm Reich, where Wilhelm Reich is useful is he had a concept that that repressed emotions got stored in the muscles, as he called it, body armor. And so deep pressure massage can sometimes release repressed emotions. He got off into some stuff that's a little strange, the orgone thing, and he got put in jail for something or other. He did.
Right. I don't want the FDA to start burning all your books.
No. I mean, Wilhelm Reich is interesting, but he's a little bit odd. I think Jung has his whole collective unconsciousness, and all this stuff is very interesting. And I once came across a pamphlet by a dog trainer in San Francisco who had obviously been either in therapy with an Adlerian, Adler was one of Freud's disciples, who talked about the will to power and will to this and will to that. And he talked about a dog's will to freedom and the dog's will to dominance. And so, but I think Freud is, Freud is problematic because there were a lot of things about his opinions on women and repressed sexual memories, et cetera, that that are problematic. But getting back to the bedrock of just the basics of the philosophy, I think it's very helpful in understanding, and it goes, it's perfectly in alignment with Kevin's energy theory, because Freud's theory of consciousness is, in fact, an energy theory based on the laws of thermodynamics. So,
and it's worth to completely bring it back full circle and ground it in the doorknob. A great example of how if someone was experiencing something like this with their dog and their only thought was, how do I stop my dog from licking doorknobs, then
right,
they're missing the point.
Right.
As opposed to what is my dog trying to express,
right,
by licking the
doorknob? What's going on inside the dog that causes, because it's obviously neurotic. It's obviously compulsive because it's not conservation of energy. You know, most dogs when they're at home, or when people come over, they grab a toy and they bring it to the person, or they wag their tail, or they sniff the person, and that's it. Most dogs don't spend 20 minutes licking a doorknob. So yeah, when the dog's behavior falls outside of the normal range, the question shouldn't be, whatever it was you said about, you know, this is wrong, the dog shouldn't do that, how do I stop the dog from doing it? It's why is the dog doing that? What causes the dog to be using so much energy for this behavior?
Yeah, and then it all comes down to a dog just trying to figure out what to do with their energy.
Right.
So it's simple. The ultimate question is simple. I mean, there are plenty of variations on the theme of how you answer the question. But what I like about it is you don't need a huge, complex system of explanation.
Right.
To get
that's
at what's
true.
Really going on.
That's true. And like you say, people think Freud is very cerebral and stuff, but actually, when you sort of get away from all of the, the complicated explanations of things, and obviously dogs aren't, speaking of complicated, dogs don't have complexes the way human beings do, and you can't put them on a couch and have them talk about their feelings and free associate, but you can understand them better if you see that just that simple dynamic of, and this has been proved recently to be true through neuroscience. They're showing that the id actually is the hippocampus and the limbic system, and the ego is the prefrontal cortex, and that it's an energy system, that the ego gets depleted of energy when it puts too much impulse control on the thing, et cetera, et cetera. So it can all be brought back to actual science, but the basic simple thing is that there's emotion, there's urges, there's impulses, and there's the human need with the dog to say, okay, now sit and stay and stop that. Don't do that. Do this. And once we can start to see it in terms of the unconscious and the conscious, or in terms of the unexpressed emotion and the control mechanisms, and channeling the energy in playful ways, the better off both the owner and the dog will be.
Absolutely. Well, I think at this point we've definitely filled the brains of our listeners.
Yes, they haven't just tuned out and said these guys are crazy.
Right, they're tuning. Are they still talking about Freud? We're not talking about Freud anymore.
I'd rather talk about Charlie. It's just I get choked up when I think about dogs who are so misunderstood, and there's something so simple as just running around and playing with them that, you know, that can bring such happiness.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it's so involving so much less struggle. And
yeah.
And I think that, you know, for dogs, I mean, it's definitely true, but you know, for owners, it's the people who are like engaged in this huge struggle of why is my dog not the way I want them to be, and what am I doing wrong, or you know, feeling like they have to manage every aspect of their dog's behavior.
Right.
It really frees them up to use an approach like this. And takes a lot of the pressure off, which, you know, again, I think is one of those things that's, you know, really transformative, not just for the Charlies of the world, but also for the owners of the Charlies of the world, who are
absolutely,
you know, freaking out a little bit.
Well, like I said, you know, I mean, my life changed the day I worked with that dog, Mickey, just testing one of Kevin's. I mean, my life changed. I mean, there was a substantive change in my perception of the world, in that here was what I thought was a problem that I had to solve. And yeah, I solved the problem, but more importantly than that, I saw dogs and myself and my relationship to nature and reality in a whole different way, because the energy that got transferred, again, you know, using a Freudian term, it got transferred from the dog coming toward him as the object of aggression, and I became not the object of aggression, but I became the object of attraction, because that's what it is. He saw the other dogs as an object of attraction, in Freudian terms, and suddenly I became the object of attraction, and to have that all that energy plugged into me, but in a very controlled, disciplined, and because to think that he had such aggression and such rage and such huge teeth, you know, and such a huge head, and yet when he projected that onto me, he was just so tender about not touching my hands and only touching the tennis ball, that it's amazing. Dogs are amazing.
Yep, absolutely.
We just have to respect them for being dogs. Yeah.
Well, again, it's been so great to talk to you, and I think we've covered some really interesting and useful territory for people listening. So I'm really looking forward to the feedback that we get.
Me too.
And we've talked about doing a conference call, much like we did with Kevin. So I think that hopefully that will be in the works, and people who are curious to talk to Lee and ask him questions directly, they'll have an opportunity to do that. And if you're in New York City, you have a great resource right there. And I know that, Lee, you're also available for consultations over the phone and online as well, right? So best thing is to Google Lee Charles Kelly or go to his website, and you'll find lots of great information, and both about Lee and about the way that he trains, and some techniques spelled right out for you on his website. So thanks again, Lee.
Well, thanks, Neil.
Absolutely.
It's great talking to you.
Likewise. And I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Can you hear the construction sounds? They're doing construction on the roof of my building.
Excellent. Well, they picked the perfect time to start. Good thing they woke up late on Saturday morning.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Take care.
All right, thanks.